like getting married, Nathan.
Careful now.
Exceptionally brilliant for a lot of people, and Mbappe has that quality.
For the best Euro 2020 coverage, subscribe now to the OTB Football Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and download the OTB Sports app.
The OTB Podcast Network with GetsetGo. Quick Start Car Insurance that's ready when you are. Sort your policy anytime online at GetsetGo.ie.
Dad Pod.
This is a video thing as well.
Have a name.
Podcast.
A midlife crisis.
Howdy Daddy.
Midlife crisis.
Dadcast.
That's not bad, actually. Yeah. All right, you're very welcome along to the latest episode of Dadcast. We really are living up to our guarantee that we were going to deliver a podcast every other week. And I'm delighted to say that we're joined today by the usual dads. Obviously, Dave, how are you getting on?
Hello, how are you?
Nathan, how are you doing?
Hey, Adrian.
And Jared's not with us this week, but we have a very special guest, Paul O'Connell. You're very welcome to Dadcast.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Definitely an upgrade, isn't it? Jared.
Similar weight, but Paul's about 8 inches taller. So,
Jesus, this really is off to a fire.
Well, I know what Jared said, pot kettle, but...
And listen, he's not here to defend himself. It's very, very tough.
It is.
How are you keeping, Paul?
I'm very well, thanks. Yeah, good form.
Good stuff. Well, look, we've lots to get through over the next hour or so. You're here because you're a Gillette ambassador, and we're delighted to have you in that context. You've shot a video that I've just been having a look at there, and it's an interesting piece, and it's thought-provoking and conversation-provoking. Do you want to give us the essence of what it's all about?
Yeah, well, look, it's just, it was a bit of fun, really. We were talking about, I suppose... I definitely struggled one time at one stage, even though I love rugby and love what I was doing, I struggled to enjoy it because I would say, you know, we've made winning and losing into a life or death situation. And I suppose the ad is just about putting your best face forward, trying to, without the cliche of it, I suppose, just trying to understand and figure out and get to a place where doing your best is good enough. And I suppose it's about trying to teach kids that, you know, I don't think you ever get over winning and losing and how important winning is, certainly as a professional player. But when I got to a better place in it, I definitely enjoyed the game more. I was definitely a better player. I was definitely a better leader. I was definitely, I think, a better teammate and easier to be around. And I think if we can teach kids that, it's really important. So my daughter is actually in the video for a little bit of it. And she's 6, so playing a lot of sports and trying to make her understand it's not all about winning and losing. But she's probably the most competitive of all my kids. So
you're not trying to put the fear of God into them at her.
With pigtails on. Yeah.
When was the last... When did you stop enjoying it, Paul? Like, were you 14 or when you turned professional?
I wouldn't say I stopped enjoying it. I would say I struggled to enjoy it. No, it definitely wasn't when I was 14. It would have been in the professional ranks, and it would have been after... In my early days... You know, I wouldn't have been a senior player. I wouldn't have been, I think, you know, I wouldn't have been marked. You know, I didn't get into the academy in my first year, and then I played Irish 20s. I managed to get into the academy after that, and then I got on the track. But I still don't know if I would have been marked as a future, you know, Irish international or whatever. But once I got into the Irish team, and once I became a senior player in the Irish team, and once I started probably... taking responsibility and ownership and accountability over whether we won or lost, that's probably when I started struggling to enjoy it a bit. Whereas in my early days with Ireland, you know, I remember in the World Cup in particular in 2003, I didn't know if I was going to start going out there. Out I went, I managed to get a starting place, but there was very little pressure on me. Everything I did was a bonus. Anything good I did was... you know, it was highly praised. And so after that, things, I would say, began to change. And we had quite a good leadership group, you know, guys that, as I said, took ownership, took responsibility. I think, and I hope we didn't blame coaches when we lost. We took it on ourselves. And I think a bit of the stress came in with that. And I probably, I always loved it, as I said, loved training, loved traveling, loved matches, loved meetings, loved arguing with people and trying to solve problems and that. But just definitely struggled to enjoy the build up to the big games. And generally, once the ball was kicked off, it was fine because you couldn't live in the future anymore. You had to live in the moment. But up until kickoff, it was pretty tough at times.
So what's the message in this Gillette initiative to try and get it into the kids' minds that they really just need to go out and enjoy themselves? Because I'm coaching under seven soccer and GAA. And when you get into the little trainer matches, all they're asking is, what is the score? And they keep the score themselves, even though the score is irrelevant. They're telling me it's 2-1, it's 3-1. Yeah. My fella's getting upset because they were beaten 4-1. This is only like a 7-minute game.
Yeah,
it's Dave,
to be fair.
Look at the coaching there.
Yeah, absolutely. It was an issue there, a defensive issue.
But how do you get that message across that, look, it doesn't matter, lads, just score the next goal?
It does matter, though. It does matter, you know. Competing is great fun as well. You know, I always look back as that was probably one of my biggest strengths, not necessarily my ability as a rugby player. It was my ability. I was competitive and I was a competitor. But so I don't think there's anything wrong with keeping score when they're young. I think appreciating, you definitely need to be more mature to understand it, but appreciating, I suppose, how much fun you are having, how many friendships you have, how many experiences you're gathering. Because I end up doing stuff from time to time, Q&As with various players and different things. And they're all, you know, guys get asked about their best memory, and very few of them mention about winning a trophy or lifting the trophy or whatever. They'll talk about some obscure day when they played Gwent Dragons away, and or the 2 weeks after they won something or whatever. You know, I think when you get older, it's very rarely the winning and losing you look back on with the fondest memories. You look back at all the different parts along the road to maybe winning or losing.
But how do you talk to a kid about that? Like where Dave says, like I find that difficult. Even I find myself checking myself with like nieces or nephews who are a bit older than my kids, who've come back from sport, and like the first thing you want to go, did you win or did you score? And you have to really check yourself to go.
Is that not the problem? That the parents are the problem rather than the kids? Because I'm similar to Dave. Mine are slightly older, so we're starting to go games this weekend. I was having this conversation with some of the coaches around competitiveness, and you know, we did some stuff on the show with New Zealand sport, and they're raising the age of competitiveness all the time up to sort of 13, 14, and the other coach is saying, well, you're not going to have players dropping out because they'll have no interest. Like, there's no keeping scores. Like, as you said, Paul, the kids always keep score. The problem is when the parents start keeping score. Like, you can do a penalty shootout at the end of a training session. That is competitive sport. Somebody will end up in tears at the end of that penalty shootout. It's when the competitiveness is, well, actually at 12, the coach is upset with you because you didn't perform as a 12-year-old to win the match that they wanted. Like, the kids are going to be competitive no matter what.
Yeah.
So let them at it. It's when you start heaping that pressure of winning and losing on them, I think the problem starts.
Yeah, well, isn't that the beauty of sport? Like, you know, my oldest boy says please and thank you, but my two youngest ones don't. I see it as a long-term project to teach them how to do that. I don't have one answer that I can... I don't have one one-liner that I'm going to say to them that's going to make them do it for the rest of their lives. But that's what you got to do with kids in sport, isn't it? They're getting these little obstacles put in front of them all the time where they're losing, and they lose a match and they want to lose their mind over it, and they have to learn not to lose their mind over it. And they win a match and they want to rub it in the other team's face, and they have to learn not to. And they get dropped and they want to give up, but they have to learn not to. And you can only do that by, you know, supporting them. And, you know, when they come in from training, maybe asking them, was it good crack? Rather than did you win, even though we all want to do it and we all probably get around to finding out if they won or lost or scored or didn't. But
yeah, quietly sitting on the couch a half an hour later. So,
But like they just have to learn that over time, don't they?
I think for the rest of us, Paul, like I'm happy to speak for the other lads that like obviously the levels that we reach, which is why we've done this with our career rather than doing what you've done, have been so pathetic that it doesn't feed into our conversations with our kids around achieving in sport. How do you find it at all difficult to separate, or had you to go through your own process of separating the dad from the professional sports person in terms of those sort of like quite lofty ambitions or concepts of enjoying sport?
I probably do. You have to remind yourself, you just want them having the crack and enjoying sports and learning all the good things. I mean, I think if they can learn, I mean, I grew up swimming and I always think of three families, the Mulcahys, the Kearneys and the Walshes. And we used to swim in Limerick, and the Walshes lived in Newmarket and Fergus, and the motorway didn't go the whole way from Newmarket and Fergus to Limerick. It was a 45-minute drive for them to come to training. And we used to train before school, 6 to 8 in the morning, Tuesday, Wednesday. I used to only do Tuesday and Wednesday before school. They used to do Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And then we used to train after school in the evening, 6 to 7, Monday to Thursday, then 7 to 9 Friday, 9 to 11 Saturday, and 8 to 10 Sunday. And they were never, ever missed training, never, ever late for training. And it was just the norm, you know, that you never miss training. You'd have to have the flu, a bad flu, to miss a training session. I never remember the Mulcahys, the Kearneys, or the Walshes. And they all went on to be fantastic swimmers and win national titles and all that. And I think that's one of the things I'd love for the kids to learn, not necessarily to go on and be superstars, but to learn the commitment part about training, being on time for training, not being late for training, all those things, because I think I got a great grounding in that kind of thing from my swimming days. And it wasn't true, you know, as we were saying there, what do you say to the kids? It wasn't true anyone saying anything to me. It was just being in an environment where that's what you did. So we used to just copy the Kearneys and the Mulcahys and the Walshes. Yeah. We never missed training. We were committed, and we learned when you were committed and you trained a lot and you stuck to the training, your times came down. So,
sorry, Paul. I was going to say, I remember Paddy Carrington talking about his children and the outside expectations that may be put on them on a golf course. And he always said what he wanted was that his sons looked like golfers. He didn't expect them to be single figure golfers, but that when they stood up on a tee box at an outing, everyone would say that's Harrington's son, and that they would have the right posture, they would have a nice swing, and that they would be comfortable on a golf course because everybody is going to look at them and expect something. And I guess, again, that's where you're going to be very different than we are, that when your kids go out onto any sporting field, it'll be, that's Paul O'Connell's young lad. That's Paul O'Connell's daughter. And there's an automatic an external expectation on them that may not be there for other kids. Have you seen that, or do you think that is going to be something they'll have to deal with?
I would say they might have to deal with it. Like Paddy, my oldest boy isn't too bothered about rugby. He plays it, but he doesn't go to bed thinking about it. He goes to bed thinking about golf and Formula One. Those are his games. And it suits, you know, I think that's probably the best scenario really for him, you know.
So he's picked the two most expensive sports in the world.
I know. Yeah. But it's great fun, you know, following sports with your kid. I mean, that's my memories growing up, is how we most related to my dad, is just, it was sports. And if there was an Irish player playing, if Peterborough were playing Wickham on TV and there was an Irish guy was left back for Peterborough, my dad could shout for Peterborough like they were his number one team, you know. And so I'm happy he has an interest in sports and he enjoys watching it and chatting about it and shooting the breeze.
That's an interesting one in itself, Paul, because I know that, like, having chatted on the Dadcast over the last couple of years about, like, the point where after you become a parent, it starts you to think about your own parents in a very different way. And, like, maybe that's the better question of all of this, about how your parents, like, produced a world-class sports person. Was that quite an organic thing? Was that just bringing you to stuff as opposed to, like, prodding and poking at you?
Well, we've three boys. I'm the youngest of three boys. We grew up in a bungalow in the country with a lovely half acre out the back garden. And we had, you know, other kids up and down the road, similar age, so we could put together a match fairly easily. I would have watched my older brothers all playing sports, so I would have been trying to copy them. Then I had an older brother, he's a year and 9 months older than me, Marcus, so I was always trying to play and compete against him. So I generally did okay against kids my own age then. And it was just, you know, sports on the TV all the time. We were lucky we didn't have a Commodore 64 or whatever they were, whatever was
you,
around.
You felt really aggrieved at the time, obviously.
Yeah, oh, it was war over. We had a pool table, though.
What a Steve Davis pot black, was it? Or what?
Yeah. It was a very small pool table, yeah. And but it was just sport on in the house all the time on TV. So sport was our thing. And that's you know, when Wimbledon was on, we had a lovely piece of tarmac there. We used to put pallets up across the garden and we used to draw chalk on the thing. We used to make tennis courts. You know, when the golf was on, we used to mow the lawn down low and play golf out the back. When the snooker was on, we were playing snooker. When the darts was on, we got a dartboard. Regular Irish childhood, playing loads of sports. And I think playing loads of sports then, when I eventually ended up playing rugby at about 16, I had, you know, had a good bit of, I suppose, fitness, coordination, hand-eye coordination, that kind of stuff. Mm. You know, I don't think my dad had put any pressure on me to play sports, but there was always a thing. There was always any sport we wanted to play, there would be an opportunity to play it, provided. Yeah.
That's a real problem nowadays, because you do get to, you see kids maybe 6, 7, 8, 9, and they still don't know how to throw. They still don't know how to kick. They probably haven't climbed a tree. You can see when they're running that the running style is all wrong. And you have to actually, in an official capacity, almost break it down and start from scratch at that age, where when you're throwing darts or hitting putts or trying to hit a tennis ball when you were 6, 7, and 8, every time Wimbledon was on, we were on the road lashing tennis balls down the street at each other. No one ever had to teach us that thing. It was a natural, organic development in your physiology that by the time you were 10, you'd been throwing and hitting and kicking for six years. It's a real problem nowadays with young kids.
Yeah, and there used to be loads of basketball courts around as well, is my memory growing up. So we played loads of basketball. You know, I played a little bit in school for our school team, but I played loads of basketball, but very little competitive basketball where I had a jersey on. Like we had a basketball court out the front of my house growing up that my dad got put up. I mean, it was hours and hours and hours of matches and games. We'd families coming up from down the road. People would cycle over because we had a really good basketball ring and we had tarmac, so the ball bounced straight. And, you know, so we taught ourselves how to run, catch, sidestep. So I think that's the thing, you know, that kids need... you know, you got to bring your kids to sports. You got to bring them to rugby and football and all that. But the more you can provide ways that they can play games themselves for hours on end, where you're not the ref or you don't have to be out there with them, I think that's where they really learn, isn't it? And, you know, that's one of the challenges I think we have in rugby in Ireland is a lot of kids play rugby, but I don't think they necessarily go out and play a game of touch rugby in groups, whereas they do that in New Zealand. You know, there's touch rugby on at small break, big break, touch rugby on after school, and then they train in the evening with their club, whereas I'm not sure how much of that we do until we go training with our club in the evening.
Do we overplay? Like, I'm conscious of people listening to us and sort of thinking it's like a bunch of men in their late 30s or 40s. And listen, the kids aren't out in the street enough these days playing sport. I wonder, have we lost touch? Or like, is there, I don't know, is there a different, you have kids, Nathan, obviously at that age that are.
Yeah, but I've said before, I'm quite lucky in that we have a green, like an old traditional green right outside our house. And I would look out here at 3 o'clock this afternoon and there'll be 10 lads all between 6 and 10 kicking lumps out of each other, playing football. One of them will go off crying. They'll come back. As you say, they're their own referee. They're falling over the place. And it's brilliant. But like, the country has changed dramatically since we grew up, where, as Paul said, you know, traditionally you'd grow up in that sort of bungalow or even on the outskirts of a city, and there was lots of green space. Like, the majority of people now live in cities. There's very little green space. The government haven't kept pace with, you know, build massive estates, never followed through with what was meant to be there and sort of the recreational side. So like, for an awful lot of people, it's impossible unless you break, the only outlet they have is the organized training session, because where do you find that plot of space where you can let your kids go and run and just, as you say, run into each other, fall over, get used to getting a proper bang, not having daddy around to go cry into. So I think it's a big old talking point that doesn't have a straightforward answer.
Yeah. Green space is massive. We live in a cul-de-sac, so we have a great setup. You know, they leave in the morning, and you don't see them till they're hungry. It's great.
Well, this is obviously
it's great from like you get a break point of view.
It's not like a great dad.
Well, that was going to be our next question, because it is obviously the dad cast, and we have been chatting about being dads for years now, right from when our kids were newborns, and Nathan's two older boys now are like heading towards 10. So what is it like being a dad for you? What sort of a dad are you? What's for you, what is the best part about being a dad?
God, I think it's just the crack, really, isn't it? It's just the stupid, the conversations where you're not too, you know, you're not too worried about where the conversation is going. Like, I enjoy getting up, doing the breakfast, bringing them to school. I'm lucky with the work I'm in at the moment. I get the chance to do that. I enjoy collecting from school, just shooting the breeze and the silly stuff, I suppose. I think it definitely makes you more patient, and it definitely makes you play the long game. You know, certainly in rugby or in coaching, you're always looking for the killer one-liner that can solve the problem or flick the switch for someone that makes them do what you want them to do or we need to do. But it's like we were saying there about the please and thank yous. It's a long-term project. And I think the patience bit has been great for me anyway.
Do you lose your rag with them?
I probably do, yeah. I probably do sometimes, yeah.
That must be fearsome.
I can put on. I can put on losing the rag. That can be good.
It's a skill.
But what's the best part? I don't know. It's all the mundane parts are the best part, aren't they? You know, we're lucky. I used to eat my dinner watching Home and Away with my dinner on my lap. Whereas Emily's family, they all sit down together, so we do that at Emily's behest, and that is great fun. You know, the arguing, not the arguing, but the manipulation that has to go on to get them to eat their dinner, and the chats that comes out about school or whatever is happening at the time. That's probably, you know, those mundane bits are probably the best part, aren't they?
How hands-on are you, Paul? Like, you mentioned there about making the lunches and stuff. Is it 50-50?
It's probably not 50-50 with the cooking at the moment, because, you know, I'd have a pretty heavy workload, but I'd say most of the other bits would be 50-50, maybe.
Starts whispering it there.
yeah. I think, I hope she'd say that now if she had her on the Momcast, if she have one.
Not yet.
That's the next project, yeah. Yeah, we've all been through that sort of casting forward, what the percentages is, and then I certainly got back to have a chat with my wife afterwards. I've been like, I said it was 50-50. Is that about right?
Yeah, just in case you hear this, I was under pressure and I just did it.
That's right. Yeah, it just came out.
But the 50-50 is interesting how you break it down, and that, you know, Paul, you say you bring the kids to school and pick them up from school. You wouldn't count that, I'd say, as part of the 50-50, because it's just something you really enjoy doing.
Oh, it's a dust, yeah, it's great.
It can be, you mentioned about losing the rag there, and like, people tend to be like, do you know, one thing that I find great is that and I bumped into somebody at the, and I must say hello to him, Peter at the park on Sunday, who was mad keen to talk, big Dadcast fan, very relatable.
This guy definitely sounds made up.
Yeah.
He
had three kids, I think, at the playground in Honey Park, great playground, but it must be very frustrating for the people who live in Honey Park when there's millions of people coming in to use it. It's like Disneyland. He has three kids, I think three daughters. I think he said there were 6, 5, and 4. So, but wasn't sure if that was the end of it. So, I mean, it felt to me to be a very planned process of we'll do that, and then we'll finish. But sorry, I'm totally thrown as to where the hell we were going with this. What were we talking about?
you're just trying to show off in front of Paul that you went to the playground and somebody recognized who you were.
Oh, yeah, listen, it's what's rare is beautiful, Nathan. You got to get it out there.
Is that, The losing the rag is something we talk about sometimes, in that it's one of the things, like when I look back at, say, when my parents would lose the rag, when you're a kid, it's such a serious, important thing. But when you're a parent and you lose the rag, like you've forgotten about it 2-3 minutes later, that actually at the time, like the kids are looking at you going, Jesus Christ. And that they never realize that actually, I don't want to say you don't care, but like this is it's just something you've done and you've moved on and you probably sat down and watched TV and forgot it even happened. And you wouldn't, like, do you wonder what mark that leaves on them, those moments of losing the rag?
They need a bit of adversity in their lives.
I would have thought it was the opposite though, Nathan.
I would have thought, yeah.
Whereas if I, and Paul, we're not going to assume that you've listened to every back episode of this podcast.
Or any.
Or any of them.
That's one.
Or that you know of its existence before 11 o'clock this morning.
But I'd hope that when Adrian said Paul was coming on and mentioned the Gillette thing, that you might have left that a bit longer and said that maybe when Paul was down in Carton House relaxing, he just loved to listen to Dadcast and use those pearls of wisdom when he went back into the coaching room.
But I used to email myself, Paul, before I fell asleep, send an email, and in the subject line it would be "Don't lose the rag." So it'd be the first thing I saw the next morning when I checked my email. A little reminder that even if they make your blood boil over the next 12 hours, that you're not going to lose your rag. Because I looked at it the complete opposite way, Nathan. When I really, when the red mist ascends, I carry that with me for hours and probably think about it the next day. Whereas I look at the two lads and it's like it never happened 10 minutes later. They've just completely forgotten that daddy has absolutely lost the plot.
And didn't just you throw one of their bicycles over a hedge one time?
That's completely incorrect. It was a scooter. Yeah, I fired it into a park over a hedge once. But like, look, there's no need to rake over those stones. That's, we've dealt with that. I think that might have been the thing that led to move on. I'd rather you didn't bring it up again.
That might have been.
We're going to rake over those stones.
That might have been the thing that led to the emails, if memory serves. But I think Dave is just dropping out in us there. I think at a very timely moment, obviously. That point, Paul, about sort of like the stuff that you were saying about the please and thanks, about trying to get them to eat the dinners or whatever. There are all those moments during the day where I would be in more Dave's camp, I have to say, where I think that the kids go, like I would often say to my young fella, like I take him away after he's lost the rag. And I try and get a quiet moment where we can calmly discuss what happened. And like, I find that like a minute, and he's 4 and a half now, but so he's not maybe old enough to understand those concepts. But I do find that like a minute into the conversation, I'm saying to him, now, do you understand what I'm saying? He can't even remember why we're talking. Like,
he's totally
lost on.
Yeah.
What's your sense of those things or that, like Nathan's
point? I remember my dad, whenever he lost the rag, because he's such a kind of a softie that we actually used to end up laughing, which used to make him even angrier. That's one of my memories of it growing up. But look, when my guys, yeah, we always speak about a day in Italy. We were on holidays and Paddy was only three, and I lost the rag with him and really gave out to him the first time ever. And he came in and he was like, everything was please and thank you and sorry. And you know the way they don't know when sometimes you say, what do you say? And they go, please, thank you, sorry. They don't know which is the one they fired them all that day. Yeah, right. And Emily always talks about that day, about how nice he was and how good he was for the next few days after. But the other two that came after him, it doesn't have the same effect. Like, you know, you lose the plot with them. You might get the get them to apologize to the sister, or the sister to apologize to the brother, barely, and then they move on and they're back to the way they were. So,
are you wary, Paul, of being Paul O'Connell admonishing his children in public? Do you worry that someone will see you like wagging the finger and laying down the law, and they're like, oh, that's Paul O'Connell roaring at his kids?
Yeah, I don't. I wouldn't do it in public now. I'd be very much undercover, kind of pretending to hug him, but I was actually threatening him.
When you get home. Do you treat your children differently? Do you worry about your children differently, the boys and the girls? Like, I know, say my eldest lad is 9 and a half, and you know, he's entering that age where he's getting into computer games. Some of his friends are starting to have phones, and I wouldn't say I'm massively concerned, but I talk to friends of mine who have girls in the same class, and they are scared shitless about what the next 3-4 years will bring for them because of social media and all of that. Do you have different worries about your boys compared to girls?
No, I'd be my only thing is that I really love the kids to play sports, whatever sports it is. I'd really love to play, and I'd love them to keep playing them into adult, you know, not just to play it into adulthood, not just to play it till they're 13 or 14. And I've a 6-year-old girl that I'm hoping gets the bug for some kind of a sport and keeps playing it. And you know, it's so easy for the boys. Like, there's so many other boys that are into other sports around them, whereas that isn't necessarily the case for the girls yet, even though I think we're heading in the right direction. And I was at a marketing thing about a year ago, but there was a lady from the I think Scottish Football Federation, and she was into promoting the game for women and girls. And one of the things she said was, she asked the people in the room, you know, who have boys and girls, when you have boys, you buy them jerseys straight away and you take a photo of them. You know, I've photos of my boy with holding a hurley when he can only lie in the cot, and there's a rugby ball in the cot, and there's, you know, all kinds of stuff. And we didn't do that for my daughter, you know. And she was saying that that's what we do, you know. We pretend, or we think we want all our kids we want our girls to play sports, but subconsciously we actually don't give them the same encouragement as we give our boys. And I was texting my wife, because I'm always arguing with my wife, we should be dressing her in tracksuit bottoms and jerseys the same as Paddy. My wife kind of dresses her a little bit girly and stuff, but and so that'd be my only worry. I was chatting to a lady the other day. She's 32, she's two kids, and she was talking about dying to be able to get back training. She plays camogie, I think, and you know, I'd love for my daughter to be, you know, in her 20s or in her 30s and playing GAA or rugby or playing golf or whatever it is. But they definitely don't get the same encouragement. I think some of the ads on TV at the moment are great. You know, I think there's a brilliant ad, a Paralympic ad where Ellen Keane is in it. So those, just, you know, I know it's a cliche, but you know, the girls need to see other girls playing sports on TV, on the newspaper, on TV ads, to keep them playing. And I'd love for Lola to keep playing sports.
I've broached the idea with my wife of inventing that career, sporting career that she had by way of being a role model for the for our youngest, that she'll grow up thinking that her mother was this amazing, let's say, intercounty camogie player, and you know, played in front of 60,000 at Croke Park, and then by the time it's like too late, that it'll already have infused and inspired her to play sport. That it'll be too late. That by the time she realizes it won't make any difference anyway, she'll have already. But I don't know how that's going to work. But I did actually think, Paul, when you were chatting there about so we've a boy 4.5 and then a girl 2.5, and I've noticed a lot. I would do a lot with the younger one of like kicking the ball with her or trying to play a bit of sport with her, and she really responds to it. Like, and yeah, and like, I don't know if I was a dad 10 years ago or 20 years ago, that maybe I wouldn't have done that sort of stuff. But like, there's no barrier to her. Like, she's as mad into it as maybe more than he is. And it's just about fostering that passion and inclusion almost. But as you say, it's, you have to consciously nearly engage in it.
I suppose the barrier to her is that, you know, when a boy goes into school, there's a whole lot of other boys talking about Ronaldo and Messi and all that kind of stuff. And it just isn't there as much with girls yet. Whereby they have a peer group that's talking about sports and playing sports nonstop. So that's the challenge, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah. The jerseys one is an interesting one. Although I will say, with the 4.5-year-old, he was given a Leinster jersey recently, and you'll enjoy this one, Paul. He won't put it on him. So I don't know if he's waiting for a Leinster jersey or what's going on, but he ain't getting it anytime soon anyway.
Why won't you get him a Munster jersey?
Well, he has no connection to Munster at all, and I couldn't endorse or encourage anything that would be sending him that direction, Paul.
Yeah, but why have you got that thing behind you then on the wall?
That's a good question. I mean, that's an entirely different podcast. I bought that at an auction. It's a program from the famous New Zealand game in 1978.
Yeah,
and it has a menu inside the whole works, so what the lads were eating that day.
Okay, lovely.
But that's what that's doing there. My thirst for good match programs, Paul, knows no boundaries of rivalry.
Give me the impression that you were.
I wouldn't want to do that, Paul. I'd be mistaken. You'd be vastly mistaken with that.
Nathan, no, I'd say you were back in the day, Adrian.
I was not. But you go
had
in.
The Leinster potential.
The only province I haven't been accused of supporting so far is Ulster, but I'm sure at some point that'll come my way as well. Go on, David.
Sorry, Paul. Are you absolutely happy for the kids to play rugby? Would you be happy if Paddy, for example, or one of your Lola was ended up playing rugby into adulthood and at a professional level, given all the talk around head injuries and the fact that your generation are sort of the guinea pigs for the first tranche of professionalism, and we're unfortunately now starting to see some of the results of that coming down the tracks?
I would, yeah. Tentatively, I think it's a great place to learn rugby very, very young is a great way to learn. You know, if you can learn to tackle young, you learn a very important skill at a very important age when people are small and they're not so fast. So I'd be very happy for them to play rugby. I would be tentative about it, and certainly professional rugby. But you do need to be strong, I think, as a professional rugby player. I'd be very worried if my kid, you know, was a good rugby player and then, you know, wanted to be a professional rugby player and it wasn't happening in Ireland, and he went into the lower leagues in the UK to try and do it, or the lower leagues in France to try and do it, because you know, you the budgets mean playing groups are small. I think guys play injured quite a lot, and a lot of the thinking is quite short term. So, but yeah, I'm happy for them to play rugby. Happy because maybe I have the knowledge, I think, as well, of what's right and wrong in terms of tackling, and I'd know when they've when they've had a bang or a proper bang. Would I like to see him going playing professional rugby in the lower leagues or leaving Ireland to play professional rugby? Not that I don't think it's heading that way anyway, but I wouldn't be mad about that, because I see, you know, I see even my short time in Paris, budgets are so tight, promotion, relegation financially to clubs is so important that a lot of the thinking ends up becoming quite short-termist and guys end up playing injured quite a lot.
Would you have had, give us your credentials, Paul, in terms of what ages are your, what makes and models have you got? We didn't establish that at the start of talk.
11, 6, and the girl, that's the girl in the middle, and then I have a 3-year-old.
There would have been, there obviously at that timeline, there would have been, and I'm fairly sure I remember somebody, you would have had some of them at games at times, would you, and sort of after the match.
Yeah, that was, it's one of my first memories is playing for Young Munsters. Any time Peter Clawsey played, at the time he was playing for Munster and Young Munsters, but any time he played for Young Munsters with us, he always had his son Luke in the change rooms with us, who was 3 or 4 or 5 or whatever age he was at the time. And he'd just sit down, but you know, there'd always be sweets or bananas or some kind of Lucozade or something. He'd have one of those in his hands and he'd be sitting down and all the players would be chatting to him and he'd be helping dad pack the bag, and then he'd be up in the bar eating a bag of crisps or whatever it was. And it's just a lovely memory. And you know, I would have been 20 at the time. Kids would have been far from my mind, but I would have always thought it would be a cool thing to do when I had kids. So Paddy used to come into the change room after games. He'd be there with Rory Best's son, Ben Best, and Mike Ross's son, Kevin Ross. And we generally, after the internationals anyway, we always said there was lots of kind of sweet, sugary foods. That's what helps you recover. So they'd be eating jellies and Jaffa cakes and all these kind of things. And there's a lovely warm-up room in under the Aviva Stadium as well. They'd be in there killing each other, the three boys. So they were lovely memories after games. You know, I don't think he even remembers them. I must ask him if he remembers them, but they were lovely moments.
He would have been about 3, say, Paul. I'm thinking maybe the Lions tour of Australia in 2013.
Yeah.
What was that like for you? Because I haven't been away for much longer than a 2-week spell as a commentator yet, but like the 2 weeks was great for the work involved, but my God, I missed them so much. What was it like being on a Lions tour, for example, and he's so young and you would just want to be spending every second at home?
Yeah, my wife ended up coming down for about 10 days during the tour. So she wasn't there for the last test. She was there for the first test, I think. So it was great to catch up with them. But honestly, I don't want to sound shallow, I didn't struggle with being away. You know, we had, I'm pretty sure we had my second child when the World Cup was on in 2015. I think. God, I should know that. But
that's fine.
I never struggled back then, but now that they're older, I do struggle. When I'm away for literally 4 days or 5 days, I would find it hard. But if I was away for 4 weeks on tour back then, I didn't struggle with it. I don't know why. But
Did
now
you sleeping great,
sleep absolutely yeah, sleeping great. I'm probably in the zone. I'm probably not glad to be away, but glad to be able to really focus, because you know, sleep is so important. It's so funny, you know, when you have kids, you know, you could really get rattled if you had a bad night's sleep before you have kids, before a big game. If you didn't sleep well, I'd be thinking, God, am I right for this? Whereas then you have kids and you have a big game and you sleep 4 hours maximum for 5 days in a row, and you go out and play, and it doesn't make a whole lot of a difference to you. So those are the challenges. But no, I never struggle with it, and I don't want to sound shallow, but I do now. Well, I do now when I'm away, and it might only be 3 or 4 days that I'm away for now.
the one area that you might cede ground in that area of being away on tour, Paul, to anybody else in this podcast is Nathan, who's a prolific tourer for long periods of time at all sorts of key moments.
No. Listen, like Paul, you know, professional, you got to go do a job sometimes. And if that means you have to go to Paris for 5 weeks during a World Cup.
Be in the zone, Nathan, be in the zone.
Stay in a nice apartment in Versailles and travel France in the middle of summer. Like that's what you got to do for, you know, the people. Yeah. I'd agree with Paul. I went to, my eldest lad was born, I think he was 4 months. I went to the Euros in 2012 to work for a couple of weeks and then came back for a couple of weeks and went to the Olympics for 3 weeks. And maybe it was because I was busy. I wouldn't say I didn't miss them, but I felt my wife was in control. Whereas now when you're away, I find, not that we get away anymore, but now when you're away, they're more crack now. So you're actually missing something, or like they're playing matches, or there's something happening that you want to be there and be able to see them and be a part of. Whereas at that age, there was just looking after and making sure they're fine, which, you know, I'm sure my wife was well capable of doing. Whereas now there's always, you know, even we're, as I'm about to head off in a minute, a big family adventure going camping this weekend. Like, they're missing all their football matches and their GA matches. Mm. And like already up by myself and the two lads are kind of, just have to stay, like, and you know, all tomorrow be around going out to like cooler or somewhere for a match and the crack that they'd have. And it'd be like 5 or 6 hours. And like, they're the things, particularly if, you know, going back, gone every Sunday to Premier League matches, you would miss. Like it was they're a training, you're not there. You're one of the only dads, is because it is still a dad thing quite often, the training. So that definitely more than ever I would miss being away for a weekend, and like my entire weekend routine now is around them, the people I hang around with. It's through their football and sports. So yeah, it's a different thing. So I'm gonna have to go, lads. A car has to be packed. Well, there's a lot of pressure on.
You have a bad record with camping. I am concerned for you, and I'm concerned for the weather this weekend if you're going camping.
Well, this is the first time in about, down to Kinvara.
Oh, lovely.
Yes. So we have camped a lot over the last 3 years with the weather, as Adrian mentioned, getting progressively worse each and every time. So this is the first time in, I think, 3 years we're going to have what looks like a nice weekend.
Yeah. Does your wife know the Euros kicks off tonight?
That was debated. yes. As she did point out, as when I raised it, she's like, well, give me a weekend that does suit you. Where there's no sport on that you would be happy to miss. So I acknowledge there's not many of them around. So yeah, the 7-year-old is more upset than I am about this and is planning his, can we watch Turkey, Italy somewhere on a phone or something? So yeah, it'll be fine. I'm sure.
Brilliant. Enjoy.
Man, well, enjoy.
All right, Paul, I hope you've learned a lot that you can take with you for the rest of your therapy from this. Never mention it again.
Yeah.
Take it easy, lads.
Good luck. Paul, just one other thing that we certainly want to talk to you about was it's a topic that we come back to a lot. We maybe touched on it a little bit earlier on, but just about that idea of your relationship with your parents as you become a parent yourself, and how you start to realise sort of the lengths they went for you, and that relationship and the questions that it kicks off, or the thoughts that it kicks off, or I have found certainly the conversations that it kicks off with my own parents, in a way, that stuff that you get to talk about that you never really would have done before. Did you find that or not?
Yeah. You know what? I found it even more from, I do a little bit of work with Bernardo's, and it's only when you start doing that and you realize some of the problems in society, and you realize how lucky you are, or I realize how lucky I was to have the childhood I had and to have the parents I had and all the things you take for granted. You know, you think it's just everyone has it, you know, like one of the things in Bernardo's is the biggest thing they do, or I think that my favorite part of what Bernardo's do is they have this thing called a breakfast club where kids that aren't getting a breakfast at home, they bring them into the school, they give them a breakfast. You know, if the mom and dad want a breakfast as well, they can have a breakfast, or they can learn how to make a healthy breakfast as well. But, you know, those kids are potentially disruptive in school, but you put that kid who's potentially disruptive and now he's hungry into a class, and he can, you know, so they feed them, they kind of get to know them, and they feed them, and they know the kid that normally comes in and he's really cheeky and full of energy and up to all sorts of tricks, and he doesn't come in and says nothing for 3 days. They know something is up and they're able to flag that, and it's just a great system. But like, you know, imagine I was a healthy breakfast every morning, chats with my parents, great lunch in my bag, you know, a hug and a kiss walking in the door to school, being told that they love me or whatever every single day going into school. You know, to think that there's so many kids in the country don't get that, it's incredible. So you end up being really appreciative for all the really simple, basic things. And even we go back to the sports piece, Suzanne Connolly, who's the CEO of Bernardo's, would be saying to me, you know, we've so many kids, the reason she likes sports is so many kids don't have one adult role model in their lives. Whereas if you play sports, you know, I look back at the amount of adult role models I had in my life through sports, you know, it's, there could be 100 of them if I had to think of them and write them down that would be encouraging you, saying the right thing to you, teaching you little lessons, positive reinforcement. So so when I think of my parents and the upbringing I had, it was just the basics, you know, being so grateful for the basics and having self-belief by being positively encouraged all the time. So, and then you see some of the challenges that you have as a parent, and, you know, I my mom in particular, my dad is great, but it was all through sports, you know. And my mom then, you know, even though she loved sports, she wasn't too bothered either way, but she was a great example for us, very hardworking woman. You know, never watched, to this day, still doesn't have time to watch TV. Wow. Which is great. So yeah, so you look, you realize how lucky you are. I suppose when you have your own kids, you realize how lucky you are. But the stuff I've done with Bernardo's, I think, makes me realize some of the skills I had, which might have made me successful playing rugby, came from my upbringing.
Yeah, does that perspective help you every day when you're a dad as well, Paul, in a situation where maybe you might feel like you're the red mist is about to descend because Paddy has, I don't know, whacked a sister around the back of the head, and you just catch yourself because you know that this is such small fry that there's another parent up the row that is dealing with an actual problem and probably dealing with that on a daily basis.
Yeah, I suppose it's like the rugby coach that blames the players for doing something. You know, that's that's what you've coached them to do. You know, it's like when you're trying to remind yourself that it's my job to teach him to, you know, to be able to handle that emotion, or to, you know, even we were in a Bernardo center there a few weeks ago, and they did a poster on the wall with all these different, a cartoon of a kid showing all these different emotions. So they use that to try and, you know, when a kid is whacking someone across the head, they're generally hungry or they've annoyed with themselves that they've done something and it's acting out the other way. You know, it's our job to teach kids that, isn't it? Whereas,
are you saying that if your child is something bold, that the first thing you do is look in the mirror? Like, surely you look at all other potential avenues of blame.
Well, you begin to consider yourself here on a podcast when I'm reflecting. That's what I hope I do. But isn't that, I suppose, I definitely learned that from Bernardo's, you know, that it's your job to teach them, listen, you're actually not angry with your sister, you're starving, you know, you didn't eat your dinner, like, can we just please eat some dinner and things might seem a bit better, or whatever it is, you know.
No, it's definitely somebody else's fault. It's definitely not a reflection on me as a parent.
yeah, I think, but I think that's an interesting part of it, you know, is the patience piece and the please and thank you is the one I always go back to. This is a long-term project. There's no point losing the plot and saying, I've told you this 100 times, you know, it's a long-term project. And I definitely didn't have that before I had kids, you know?
Yeah, we've been doing a thing here recently because we're going through, and the thing that we've definitely found, Paul, is that people who are listening are going through all the same things. And certainly that one in our house at the minute, with the youngest one, about trying to say please and thank you can be a difficulty at times. My wife, I don't know actually really where she came up with the concept, but she has this thing where she touches her nose. So she'd look at the kid and touch her nose to give her that sort of non-verbal signal that I'm coming for you. I'm expecting something here. And inevitably it actually works. I've been quite surprised and delighted by
that's higher level. I remember when Dougie Howlett, I remember sitting beside Dougie Howlett and Lefemi Maffey one day on a plane, and they had kids, and I think my youngest might have been two or something like that, but it was this book they'd all bought the book. All the Kiwi guys in Munster had bought this book called 1-2-3 Magic, and the logic behind the book is, you know, when they do something bold, you say one. And then if they do it again, you say two. And then on number three, they have to go and sit in the step. But there's all different levels. Like if you do something really bold, you can escalate straight to three. And Maffey and Dougie were talking about this book, like it had changed their lives. You know? But I remember asking them about 2 weeks later, and everything now for them was number three, straight to the step.
That's right.
I take it out from time to time and read it. And do you see, there's no point, because I'd be saying to Emily, there's no point in me reading this book if you're not going to read it as well. Yeah. You know, there's no point. We have to be aligned on the 1-2-3 here. Yeah, and she kind of might read a half a page and then trot down.
She's like, that lad, he's off. He's off on that stuff again. Dave, when he's not...
Three magic, lads. It's the secret.
That sounds like a great concept. Dave, when he's not throwing scooters over the hedge, had a great one time, Dave, about the putting the toys into the black bags and threatening to remove them.
Oh, my God. It's outrageous.
why is it outrageous? So desperate times call for desperate measures. I'm at the end of my tether. So I
that
to make
is a massive
pick.
Escalation.
It went straight to number 10.
This was not, you weren't there, Paulie. This was not an escalation. This was the culmination of a gradual process in which I was slowly but surely being turned inside out mentally and emotionally. But I just, it definitely worked for a while. They actually, you make sure they're watching you as you pick. First, you actually ask them what their favorite toy is.
Oh my God.
And then you say, right, well, if this happens again, that toy's going into the black bag. And then you let them stand at the window while they watch you carry the bag out to the boot of the car.
Oh, my God, they're going to be talking about that in therapy. So
the bag was never actually delivered to other children, as had been the threat. But it worked for a time. It worked. I don't think the scooter throwing incident worked, because the problem with that was I was definitely the victim until the scooter went over the hedge. As soon as the scooter disappears, you are now the aggressor and the child is the victim.
Yeah,
so I gave up all
ground.
I absolutely lost all my bargaining chips once the scooter became airborne. But and also, as I told the lads when I first told the story, there was somebody, another parent there who watched it and was just horrified. Who is that psychopath? Those children must lead terrible lives.
Yeah, I listened to one of the podcasts yesterday, and you were talking about your kids being in a great phase.
Yeah.
They could do no wrong.
That's right.
The golden period.
So still happening there.
Still going. It's still going. It's very hard to put your finger on what it is. And they're older, obviously, and
it's the draconian measures that you've been.
Right. Fear. Yeah.
It's a tyrannical regime under which they live. I don't know. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that days are longer. They're spending far more time outdoors. They're seeing their friends again. Their screen time is much more limited during the school term. So that's definitely going to be a challenge now in 3 weeks once the curtain falls on the school year. You have to try and maintain those 6 p.m. limits Monday to Friday. And in the morning, there's no screen time. Whereas when they're not getting up for school and no one has to be anywhere at, there's no deadline. It's very easy for them just to switch on the Nintendo or the TV. So I think all of that, they're just happier in themselves. They're eating great because they're burning so much energy at their various training sessions that they might wind up now in July for a few weeks before the new school year starts. So that's the danger. But right now we're just loving it. They seem to be generally very good to each other. And I'm aware, as has been proven in the past, this can change almost at the drop of a hat. So yeah. I'm enjoying it for what it is right now.
Good stuff.
Long may it last. Right, we've been chatting to Paul O'Connell, very special guest on Dagcast this week. It's all with thanks to Gillette and part of their Put Your Best Face Forward campaign. It's obviously for the time that is in it around Father's Day, and Gillette celebrating all role models. And Paul, obviously the country's looked up to you for long enough, and you've got three chiselers looking up to you now, and it sounds like you're doing a cracking job of it as well. So keep it up. Thanks a million for chatting to us, and we'll catch you up again down the track.
Okay, cheers guys.
Cheers Paulie.
Thanks a million.
Thanks a million. Cheers Paul.
The OTB Podcast Network with GetsetGo. Quick Start Car Insurance that's ready when you are. Sort your policy anytime online at GetsetGo.ie.